sure that's the way it works anyway.
I think I'm going to do it. Like that. That's better.
Good evening. A few people are coming in still, so we'll take a few more minutes, but we're going to start very soon. Bonsoir à tous. Merci d'être ici ce soir. Et on attend quelques instants et on commence.
The competition has not started yet.
Oh.
We have not opened it because we have one more position, and I want to fill it up.
Okay.
But it would be nice to start soon by the time we have the meeting on Lund.
You were planning on last January, so we had that first start.
Long time.
Yeah.
We went to strike the center, how we organize administration, fielding things. So, but it's moving forward.
How you been otherwise?
Good. Very good. Science is good. You know, I'm going to Japan, so I'm not going to be here. There that evening.
Oh.
Because I'm leaving in the second week of January.
What's
for
Japan?
1 year. It's work, sabbatical. My
okay.
wife is Japanese.
Oh, okay. Because one of the consults that I did for Jeanette's case is the cancer center in Tokyo. I forget the exact name, but they were very kind and they gave me a second opinion because I sent the whole file to them and they gave me analysis of their prognosis. So, they were very helpful.
Listen, we'll talk about it again tonight after.
Yeah, okay.
We'll chat a bit. We're going to start.
Okay.
But I was very happy that you noticed.
Yeah.
I thought of you when I put that into.
Okay.
Bon, bonsoir à tous. Bienvenue encore à la soirée publique du Centre de recherche Rosalind et Maurice Goodman. It's now the third year in a row we're doing this, and we always try to bring you a mix of basic science and clinical research and trying to give you a mix of those so you can learn things about what the clinician here at McGill do. Our friends at the hospital, and also what we do at the Goodman Cancer Center in research. Ce soir, on a particulièrement une belle soirée. We've decided to do a different evening than normal. The reason for that is that I think we have a title for our series this year called Waging the War on Cancer in the 21st Century. Ça, c'est un grand titre, hein? Partir au combat contre le cancer. On a vraiment trois soirées qui vont suivre celle-là on specific cancers that are very, very difficult to treat. And so we will have those evenings, some of them not pleasant. As you know, the pancreatic cancer has been something really much in the news recently with Steve Jobs. We will have, after that, a lung cancer evening to see what's the status, and something hopefully a bit more light in two sides of the way. We're going to talk about melanoma, and this is going to be just in spring when people want to go and plan their vacations on the beach. Maybe we can talk about that a bit. Et la directrice, en fait, du Centre de mélanome ici à McGill sera notre conférencière invitée. I want to talk a bit about our next evening. It's very important because we have a very special guest. I can say that now. She's not here in many ways, but recently I was looking at a PowerPoint on pancreatic cancer and sent by the Canadian Pancreatic Cancer Society or their association, and they had like 25 names of people which had pancreatic cancers, famous people, and there was a long list of those. Pavarotti is one of them, and few others, and Steve Jobs was there, and or the one which passed away for the Nobel Prize one was also on the list. And but this was like 6-7 months ago. And the only person left on that list, still alive, was Libby Znaimer. I'm not sure if I say her name properly. Is that that's right, his name. She's a journalist at on television in Toronto. She's from originally from Montreal, and she's a real survivor from pancreatic cancer. And the surgeon that operated her in Toronto is George Agopoulos, who just joined the team at the MUHC and McGill University. And he will give us an evening where he'll talk about pancreatic cancer. And Libby accepted to come, so she will come for this evening. So we'll have a very special evening with her. This is on November 22nd. So I invite you to come. So this is her. I think I'm not sure the picture is. She's in fact such a wonderful woman, and she wrote a book on Libby Zimmer in Cancer Land, specifically about her pancreatic cancer. And she's one of the rare person which has a survival over 5 years with pancreatic cancer. And we're looking forward to have her here. So. So I invite you again to come. Pour ce soir, on a trois invités. D'abord, le Dr. Wilson Miller. Wilson is a good friend for many years at McGill. But first and foremost, I know he's dedicated to his clinic. He's an oncologist, a researcher at the Lady Davis Institute. He's also the director of the clinical research program at the Department of Oncology at McGill. Wilson worked at the Department of Medicine at Cornell, also at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, one of the most famous cancer centers in the world, and joined the staff at the Lady Davis Research Institute at the Jewish General Hospital. I know that he had the FISQ Chercheur National. So this is a very privileged award because it's the top scientist in Quebec that got this. There are only few at the top. And he's a clinician, so he had time to do all of this research on top of his clinic. So it's a wonderful accomplishment. On that side, for scientists, we look at Wilson in a very positive way. He also got many awards from different institutions. He had grants for National Institute of Health, the CIHR, Ontario Cancer Network. So he's almost everywhere. And I think it's a perfect example of somebody that can bring us the latest development in cancer. So he has many things. So Wilson will have to leave after his talk, but we will, contrary to other evenings that we have normally, on va répondre aux questions immédiatement après la présentation du Dr. Miller. Donc on pourra avoir quelques questions avant de passer aux deux autres. Les deux autres personnes et non sorry Wilson, I just take 2 seconds to present our very rapidly. We'll have Anne-Marie Mesmasson, une collègue aussi de très longue date avec qui je travaille toujours et qui travaille beaucoup entre McGill et l'Université de Montréal. Oui, ça existe, ça, des partenariats entre les deux. Et puis, on aura aussi Antoinette Erler qui va terminer la soirée. Antoinette, she's the infirmière pivot. She's a perfect example of that. And so the evening is really to teach you or to discuss with you the latest advance in cancer. Comment on fait les banques de sang, les banques de tumeurs? Anne-Marie will tell you that. And what can we use as basic scientists from this patient sample? And Antoinette will show us how things happen in the hospital. How do we take care of patients into all this maze of services? Donc, on commence avec Wilson. Wilson, welcome to the Goodman Cancer Lecture. And I'll give you the microphone, I'll get your presentation.
Okay. Thanks, Michel. I should point out for anybody who doesn't know, Michel also was a chercheur national of the FRSQ.
No, that's
even if he's not very good with computers.
No, that's right. It's not my computer skills that really gave me this job. Okay, that's you, all right. And Wilson, thank you. I time you a little bit.
Okay. Thank you. So, you know, I gave a lecture of the same title a few years ago, and it was really a joy to notice that most of my slides are out of date because we really have made a lot of progress in the last couple of years, and I think that predicts future progress, which won't come quite as fast as La Presse and the Gazette say it's coming, but is coming nevertheless. So let me talk about where we've been. We've made really major improvements in several cancers, and This used to be a few rare cancers, and now it's graduated to several not-so-rare cancers. We've made enormous improvements in understanding molecular mechanisms of cancer, and what's most important is translating that understanding in the lab to something that can actually help a patient. And this brings up the concept of personalized medicine, which is an easy thing to talk about, but a hard thing to do. In cancer care, we're actually starting to do it, and I'll give you a couple examples of that. We're also making improvements, although more incremental, in the most common cancers, and we're hoping that the ongoing research based on biology and molecular discoveries will lead to new targets and new treatments. So I'm going to go back first to talk about what started me in cancer research, 20 years ago, I guess, which is a subtype of acute leukemia, and the details here really aren't terribly relevant, except that in the late 1980s in China, it was shown that a component of traditional Chinese medicine that actually worked in this rare subtype of leukemia was what we know as retinoic acid, which is the active form of vitamin A. And that, in turn, led to discovery of the molecular rearrangement that involves the vitamin A receptor called RAR-alpha, which is shown down here. And allowed an understanding of both the molecular basis of this disease and how a new treatment could make a dramatic response. So I'll just show you, this is a picture of leukemic cells from a patient with this kind of leukemia, and this is what happens after you give them a derivative of vitamin A, which is just a pill that you can take by mouth, and it has really no more side effects than Accutane. And along with this is a dramatic improvement in survival of cancer patients. And this is the typical curve that you'll see in the literature. And I'm going to show you a few things that are, sort of real data from papers, and hopefully everybody can follow. You have the y-axis here, which is people who survive. The right x-axis here is time, and as you see, people start out at 100 and they drop down. This is the group that gets classic chemotherapy for acute leukemia, and as you can see, they really didn't do well, and still we don't do very well with classic chemotherapy for acute leukemia. However, when you can find a molecular abnormality that has that can be targeted by a specific treatment, this is what happens to survival. And so an obviously very major improvement in survival discovered 20 years ago in a trial. I bring this up also because this is an example of what's called differentiation therapy of cancer, which means, and I don't know how to go back on this. I figured it out. These are the leukemic cells. What happens usually when you have a successful treatment with cancer is you kill the cancer cells and they all go away. What happened here was they became differentiated into what resemble much closer to the normal cells of the body and are therefore not harmful. This is was a paradigm for what we hope would work in a lot of cancers. It didn't. And it's taken almost 20 years for now finally some new approaches with newly discovered genes and transcriptional pathways may actually have brought back differentiation therapy. And I was really pleased to see there was a lecture by James Watson, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering DNA just a couple weeks ago at the Jewish. And his main thesis for how we were going to cure cancer was differentiation therapy with this new transcriptional approach that he'd been sort of involved with, because it came out of Cold Spring Harbor, where he was the chief. So moving on to some other somewhat more common cancers, I think pretty much everybody has heard about chronic myeloid leukemia, CML, and how important Gleevec, also known as imatinib, is. Here also, like APL, CML is characterized by a unique fusion protein, which you can target by this time not a naturally occurring vitamin, but an oral agent that was designed to target the malignant protein. And clinical trials have succeeded dramatically. This is another way of presenting clinical trial data. And if you see here, this is Gleevec, and 95% of patients treated with Gleevec in a randomized trial had a complete response. And this is the best therapy they had before Gleevec, which is interferon, which has lots of side effects, and cytarabine, which is a chemotherapy, which has lots of side effects. And there the response rate was just 50%, again, dramatically better for the targeted therapy. So, what's new in targeted therapy? This is all new since 2 years ago in melanoma. For decades, melanoma, once it had spread from the skin, if you cut it out and get it all, that's great. If you don't, once it spread, it was a death sentence, usually very rapid progressing, and chemotherapy, immunologic therapy, biochemotherapy, and a whole bunch of other ideas failed. Standard therapy was almost thought to be not worth giving. It was slightly better than nothing, but really wasn't very good. Now we have a bunch of new agents that are really starting to work, and I'm going to talk about two of them. One is an antibody that is directed not against the tumor, but against the patient's immune system, and what it does is it changes the thermostat of how sensitive the immune system is to recognizing self versus non-self, which means how sensitive it is to recognizing the tumor as something that needs to kill. And when it works, it generates an immune response that wipes out tumor almost as well as antibodies to measles wipes out measles virus. And I'm also going to show you at the same time as this antibody was developed, an entirely different approach involving, again, a small molecule pill that targets a specific molecular abnormality was also successful. So I had to show that just because we got McGill into the list of authors, and I was quite pleased about that, obviously. This is from the New England Journal this year in one of the studies. I'll just briefly show you, again, the data from the study. Not quite as dramatic as the really impressive results we had in the two leukemias, but still you can see a big difference in the curve when you add the antibody to standard treatment alone. I think this curve is going to get better because we're just learning how to use the antibody. We're learning how long it takes to work, what you need to do to allow the patient to have the time to get the antibody to work. So I think future results are going to look even better than this. I'll show you one example of what I'm talking about. This was a patient who actually was on antibody alone, had failed previous therapy. At screening, and I apologize if anybody's squeamish, but melanoma is kind of a nasty disease, so the pictures aren't pretty. The patient had a lot of oops, what'd I do? Okay. At screening, the patient had a lot of disease. You can see both in the CT scan and in the picture. The patient was started on the antibody treatment. The one problem with the antibody treatment is it works slowly when it works and never works really fast. So initially the patient had progression, was actually recorded as not being a success in the clinical trial. However, just a few weeks later, the disease turned around and started to disappear. And here, almost 100 weeks, the patient was without disease, and I think the patient has stayed without disease. So this may be a dramatic long-term response to this therapy. Okay. So the next thing is this drug that has a very long name, and it inhibits, people call it VMU for sort of short, it inhibits this oncogene that is specific to half of melanomas called BRAF. And it's actually a mutated form of BRAF that ignores the signals from the cell surface that are supposed to tell a cell when to grow and not grow, and just signals downstream to make things grow. Here's VMU, the drug, blocks the mutant BRAF, and therefore in vitro stops malignant cells with this abnormality. And in vivo, it was, again, tried in a big clinical trial. This is a typical design of a big clinical trial. You take a lot of patients and you randomize them between the standard chemotherapy, which, as I said, isn't really very useful in this disease, and the new drug, which is VMU. And here's the result in overall survival. You can see a early and significant difference between patients who are treated with the new drug and patients who were treated with the original drug. And for those who are aficionados, hazard ratio means sort of the percentage difference between the two drugs. We used to get excited with new chemotherapy if the hazard ratio was 0.8, which means it's 20% better. Here the hazard ratio is 0.37, which means it's almost three times better. So this is just a slide to talk about two things. One, the complexity of melanoma. These are the kinds of mutations you see in different subtypes of melanoma. There's a lot of BRAF, although some subtypes have more than others. There are mutations in this gene called NRAS, which we are now trying to develop targeted agents to treat. And there are in some but not other subtypes of melanoma mutations in the gene called KIT, which actually respond to Gleevec, the same drug I talked to you about for CML, and maybe even better to some newer versions. And I will just go over the pictures here, which are a little blurry. I apologize, just to say that, you know, relatively flat, not necessarily worrisome to everybody, lesions can be melanoma and need to see your dermatologist. Don't let them get this big, and for sure, don't let them get this big. And, you know, these are all melanomas that presented first time like this. And, you know, I don't know how somebody let their eye develop a melanoma like the one you see there. This is just studies of imatinib in melanoma. And I show a couple slides just to emphasize the importance of personalized medicine. somebody got the bright idea to try imatinib, Gleevec, in melanoma years ago. In fact, three groups did it, and they took a bunch of people with melanoma and treated them with Gleevec, and they got 0 out of 25, 0 out of 16, and 1 out of 21 responses, and so everybody was in complete agreement that this drug was worthless in melanoma. They did not subtype them for the relatively rare KIT mutation. So when a new study, much more recently, as you can see, 2009, came up and required people to have an abnormality in this one gene in order to be treated with Gleevec, then you got this response rate, where here the first two patients, it's always good to be the first patient in a clinical trial, got a complete response, two others got a partial response, and a bunch of patients here got stable disease, and only two patients had early progression as opposed to the majority of patients if you had taken patients who were not selected to have the specific target of the specific agent. So very important to learn what drives an individual tumor, and can we have or find or derive a drug that will target that driving oncogene and not try to attack some other pathway in the cancer cell that might drive somebody else's cancer but doesn't drive your cancer. So I'll talk a little bit about where we are in other very common malignancies. Breast cancer, we've made steady progress. Breast cancer has one targeted agent recently developed that has dramatically improved therapy of breast cancers that have the target, which is called HER2. So breast cancers that overexpress a gene called HER2 respond to Herceptin and do much better when you combine Herceptin with chemo than not. Other kinds of breast cancer, unfortunately, we haven't been so successful recently at finding targeted agents. Colorectal cancer, we have three new drugs in the past 5 to 10 years that improve survival, but they haven't really been focused in a targeted way, so the improvements are more like the hazard ratio of 0.8, not the hazard ratio of 0.3 that you'd love to see. Renal cancer, we've done a little bit better with targeted agents, although there we have agents that target pathways that we know are important in a lot of cancers of the kidney, but not necessarily all of them, and we're still trying to learn how to really find the people who are going to respond from the people who aren't. Lung cancer, we've made two advances, and one is just in patients who have lung cancer removed. In previous years, we said, well, the surgeon took what he could. Maybe it'll come back. That'll be bad. We hope it won't. Nothing to do but wait. Now we've learned that in lung cancer, as in breast cancer and colon cancer, if you remove a tumor and there's a risk of recurrence, you can treat early with chemotherapy and cure patients. So that has changed the use of chemotherapy in early-stage lung cancer. At the same time, a small percentage of lung cancers have one of two molecular abnormalities, either a mutation in the EGF receptor gene or an abnormality in another gene called ALK. And there are now targeted agents, small molecule pills, for both those specific abnormalities. If you find patients with the abnormality, give them the specific agent. They actually do much better than if you just gave them chemotherapy. So we're making progress. We're making big progress in a small percentage of lung cancer and decent progress in a greater number of patients. Finally, prostate cancer, another disease which, like melanoma, for 20 years had one treatment. Well, better than melanoma, it had one treatment that usually worked for a while. Then it stopped, and the rest of the treatments were really not very good at all. Now there's both exciting new chemotherapy agents and two different classes of exciting new hormonal agents and the new immune approach to treating prostate cancer. So I think you're going to hear more things about exciting new treatments for prostate cancer in the next few years. So in summary, we can cure some rare hematologic cancers, and more recently we find more and more molecular abnormalities, and so it's not even so rare anymore. We're curing early-stage breast and colon and more recently lung cancer. We have significantly improved survival in melanoma, especially in subtypes that have molecular targets that we can identify. I'd love to tell you we've identified the molecular profile of patients who respond to the antibody theory, but we're still working on that. And in general, we're learning how the molecular oncogenesis that leads to cancer and the molecular basis of response to new treatment that target the driving oncogenes can be linked. I would also mention briefly that we haven't completely ignored what bothers cancer patients, i.e. the symptoms of cancer, fatigue, weight loss, cachexia, inflammatory fever. You know, there are a lot of symptoms that are kind of a general problem with cancer, and we're starting to get targeted agents to the cytokines, the substances in the body that may mediate these general symptoms so that we can actually treat symptoms better as well. So I think we're making great progress in the lab, much being done at the Goodman Cancer Center that you've seen, as well as the Siegel Cancer Center and labs at the MUHC and labs at the SHUM. And clinical trials linking these laboratory discoveries to finding the right targets in the right patients to improve dramatically patient outcomes with cancer are really where I think we're making finally some good progress, and we need to make more progress. So with that, I will stop and see if there are questions.
So we have, I'm not sure we have a microphone in the room tonight. Remember, we are on strike at McGill. We're missing a few things. But if you want to ask questions, just raise your hand, say it. We'll try to repeat the question in front. And we'll soon have about 5-10 minutes. We can answer questions. And just to warm me up, you know, I'm in fact quite happy of your talk because you are a very reality check guy. And every time I talk to you, you always, you know, give me the normally not so positive answers. And I thought you were very positive tonight. So is it really your thoughts that? In general, the number of patients which are treated with cancer and survive increased dramatically recently? Or is it terminal?
I think, you know, 2 years ago, my point was we've made dramatic progress in some rare cancers and small progress in common cancers. Now we've made dramatic progress in some rare and a few not so rare cancers, and the progress in the common cancers is getting better. So I'm not all the way to total optimism. I'm not ready to say, you know, that this war on cancer that we were obviously losing for 30 years is now won. But I think, you know, the tide is turning.
Or if you want to say if you have any questions.
Okay, in the back.
Are
So, obviously, the first agent I talked about, which was derived in the 80s, was a vitamin derived from natural sources. The Chinese have thousands of years of traditional medicine, you know, which, frankly, has a lot of therapies that don't really work and a few therapies that really work well. And one of the things that modern, you know, evidence-based medicine has done in China is help Chinese scientists to figure out what in traditional Chinese medicines really works in what conditions. So, you know, they're working on personalized medicine as well. I think the more recent drugs I talked about were more designed in the laboratory, designed by computer. You know, as we understand the physical structure of molecules that get out of control in cancer, we can better design specific drugs and not just screen a million natural compounds and hope to find one that happens to fit. I think, you know, the computer-based drug discovery and drug design and then drug synthesis has come a long way from 1980 to now. Yeah, that was in part a joke and in part something that everybody seems to find, which is, well, first of all, what's not a joke is the benefit of clinical trials. None of the progress I showed you could have been done without clinical trials. If patients aren't willing to try new things, if they just say, give me what's proven, and then after that I'm going home, we won't be able to prove new things. And we're in an environment now where there are a lot of promising therapies, and they need to be proven. Because, unfortunately, what I didn't talk about tonight is some of the new therapies don't pan out. They work great in tissue culture, they work okay in mice, and they don't work in people. And the only way to find that out is to do clinical trials and to have people who want to be in clinical trials. I think there have been a lot of studies that show that people who enter clinical trials do better overall on average than people who don't enter clinical trials. There are arguments about, well, maybe they were just healthier to begin with. We don't randomize people and force you not to be in a clinical trial if you don't want to be, or force you to be in a clinical trial if you do want to be. So we don't have a perfect study for that, but I think it's true that clinical trials have benefit. And yes, it's anecdotally and halfway joking that, you know, all the new drugs work really well in the first few patients, and then somehow when you do your 500-patient randomized trial, it doesn't come out quite as good as you hoped it would.
Any other questions?
Yes. Yeah, so the treatment is for the antibody therapy for melanoma. Does it have side effects, and why does it work slowly? So does it have side effects? Yes. Pretty much every drug we give for everything, including aspirin, has side effects. This one has really interesting side effects, more interesting if you don't get them than if you do, actually. But it attacks the immune system. I mean, excuse me, it attacks the body. The immune system attacks, you know, it's not sometimes only the cancer that the hyperstimulated immune system finds is a problem. It may decide that your own gut is a problem. And so you can get what's like inflammatory bowel disease, which means bloody diarrhea, dehydration, big problems. It can attack the thyroid. It can attack other endocrine organs. So it can really attack almost anything in your normal body if it somehow doesn't figure out that the cancer is where it needs to go. The only little good news is people who have side effects have a stimulated immune system by definition, and therefore they actually are more likely to also have a response in their cancer. So we tell people if you have the side effects, you need to get treated, and we need to make sure they don't get out of control, but maybe it's a good thing. Why is it slow? The antibody hits regulatory cells that regulate the ability of the immune system to respond to antigens. But that takes time. You know, the immune system has to take time to wake up. Then it has to find that the cancer is really a problem after all. Then it has to have cells reproduce, and it has to, you know, do all the things it regularly does that require some, you know, there's a reason if you get measles, you are sick for a while. And if you previously had measles and you already have antibodies, then you don't get it, or if you get it, it's over in a day. So, you know, it takes a while to gear up the immune system generally, and then a while longer for it to specifically attack the cancer. And that's why we see cases like I showed you where it looks like it's getting worse, and if this was a traditional cancer agent, we'd say, forget it, it didn't work. But it may still work if you can stay the course. Okay, so the question is about the Oncotype DX test for breast cancer, which is a molecular test which does which looks at a bunch of genes and tries to predict whether somebody is going to need chemotherapy or not after a resection of a small breast cancer, relatively small breast cancer. So the simple answer to your question is it is used here, and it's funded by Quebec, and it's pretty much widely available as far as I know. Certainly at McGill it's available.
Is it offered by the oncologist?
Yeah, it's offered. It should be offered by the oncologist for patients for whom it's appropriate. It's not appropriate for every kind of breast cancer. But for patients in which it's been shown to be helpful to decide who needs chemo and who doesn't, we use it, and Quebec pays for it. And there's a reason, interestingly, that Quebec pays for it, which relates to the importance of personalized medicine. If you do this test, which costs a few thousand dollars, in everybody who may or may not need chemo, and you can decide who doesn't need chemo, then the savings of not giving chemo to patients who don't need chemo are hugely greater than the cost of the test. And amazingly, the Quebec government actually recognized that and therefore allows us to, you know, funds the test. It was available then through a research protocol. But once that research protocol ended and was more or less published, it's still more data is coming out, but it was recognized as probably being positive. I think it was last year.
Preventing environmental toxin have an impact on preventing cancer. So that's something the government would probably would like to do.
So the answer is yes, but the question is how much impact does an individual change in lifestyle have? We actually have a fair amount of data on that, and it sometimes gets lost in the noise of everything causes cancer, therefore you can't stop everything, therefore why bother? We actually know that cigarette smoking is a dramatically successful increase in a whole bunch of cancers. Almost every type of cancer, cigarette smoke somehow gets to the organ and increases cancer. It's not just lung cancer, it's stomach cancer, it's prostate cancer, it's all kinds of cancer is increased by cigarette smoking, including pancreas. Tanning salons have been pretty clearly shown to dramatically increase melanoma, but you have to wait 10 or 20 or 30 years, so nobody notices when they're 15 and want to be tanned. There are other specific lifestyle things that are probably a little less important. Diet is important. What everybody knows is a bad diet. The supersized Big Mac diet is associated with higher incidence of breast and colon and other cancers. And eating your fruits and vegetables and not a lot of animal meat is associated with much lower incidence of a variety of cancers. Environmental toxins play a role, but probably less of a role than, our lifestyle.
My last question is, I know a good friend of mine which has a young son, and he's bringing him to Japan right now. Would you go to Japan with your young son?
The radioactivity released outside of that local area was minimal. So, yeah, don't go tour the... The zone of damage, but in the rest of Japan he'll be fine.
Okay, but the serious question I got was, so
Yeah, I figured that.
But the last question I wanted to ask is, so how far are we for sequencing every tumor here in Quebec? And some people are thinking that this would be one way. So is this something we could see?
So I'm glad you asked that question because I'm a big believer in that. But there, unlike Oncotype DX, the cost-benefit has not been close to proven. So the cost goes down every year. Now it's maybe $10,000 or $15,000. If we sequenced every tumor, it'd probably go down to $5,000 quickly. And as people probably know, $5,000 is a month of chemo or even less for some chemos. Like that antibody, it costs a fortune. So the problem is if you sequence a tumor, you get a whole lot of information that we don't yet know what to do with. You know, instead of finding one mutation that has been proven to drive a particular cancer, we may find 473 mutations, half of which aren't really mutations, they're just variation from person to person, and we have no idea which of them is driving an individual person's cancer. So we need to have better techniques to do something with the information from sequencing, which, as a researcher, I would say the only way we're going to develop that is to start doing the sequencing and trying new techniques and doing research, and then it'll be here. It's coming. In 10 or 20 years, can't promise which of those, but one or the other, we will be sequencing everybody's cancer, I predict.
To our next speaker, let me first, that sounds like this one, a few slideshow, and I don't see about Anne-Marie. Anne-Marie, you can come slowly. Dr. Masson est une oncologiste moléculaire, c'est un chercheur avec un PhD, qui a fait de la recherche, elle a gradué ici à l'Université McGill, il y a plusieurs années, mais pas si longtemps.
Now is the director of the Institut du Cancer de Montréal at l'Université de Montréal. Institut du Cancer, good night, evening, Wilson, thank you very much. Institut du Cancer was one of the first institutes of cancer here in Quebec, if not the first one. Can you correct me on that? In North America, so that's an interesting one. Anne-Marie, her research is focused on ovarian cancer and breast and prostate cancer, and I must say to you that she's been a wonderful collaborator from the McGill side, and the many reasons, not only she's a good scientist and a wonderful person, but she is the really driving force in Quebec for tumor banking. Anne-Marie est vraiment, c'est elle qui a vraiment amené la barque au Québec pour faire des banques de tissus, banques de tumeurs, qui nous a permis d'étudier les différents types de cancers. She was also a driving force on a panel by the Quebec government to examine the law and how we can store ethically the patient samples. And this is why I wanted her to come tonight, because we, those of us which are sometime through the system, are seeing ethical questionnaire. We want to be, they want us to be part of studies. I know you're going to touch a bit of that and mainly on your research, but I think it's something that is very useful because from the patient to the bench, this is what you do. And I'm happy that you're here. Thank you very much, Anne-Marie.
So good evening. Thank you very much, Michelle, for having invited me. So what we've just heard now is a talk from Dr. Miller, who's really told us that how we're trying to treat cancer patients is really undergoing a revolution. So while in the 1990s we got generic cancer care, that means we did big clinical trials, we found out what worked on average for the average person, and that's how we gave drugs. And sometimes it would work for a patient, and sometimes it would be very toxic, and sometimes it wouldn't work at all. But we treated everybody as if they were the same. You've heard that we've started to change the way we're doing, we deliver cancer care now. We're really starting to bin people into groups and say, well, because of the kind of cancer you have, I think this is what you should be getting. And it may not be what everybody gets. It may not even be what the majority gets, but it might be the best thing for you. And I was glad to hear his concluding remarks, because really what we're talking about in the future, when we're going to sequence complete cancer genomes, is we're really going to go to individual care. So we're not going to say, well, we predict you might have this or you might be in this group. We're actually going to go to your tumor tissue. We're going to study it in depth, and then we're going to be able to, when we to match you up to the right treatment that really is the one that will stop your cancer. So that's what personalized medicine is all about. It's coming here slowly in terms of individual stratified cancer care, but eventually we hope to have it much more personalized than it is. And that requires many things. We're going to talk a little bit about something that we call biomarkers, but it's a marker that tells you what should I be giving you. So what's helping fuel this revolution? Because you've heard about now that we started to dissect cancers and we can see this gene is wrong or this translocation. What really we need is we need to have access to the actual tumor specimens to be able to do this research. In fact, this was recognized by Time magazine a couple of years ago when they said the top 10 ideas changing the world right now, and tissue banks was one of those top 10 ideas because they're really fueling research. So what is a tissue bank? So there are different types of tissue banks. So you might be recruited for a study. In fact, a large right now, there's a very big study that's sponsored by the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer, which is recruiting 250,000 healthy adults and is following them for the next 15, 20 years. So they ask to have some, in addition to some baseline information about you, they also want to have access to your blood, and they're going to store serum and DNA. You also have sometimes things that are called case control studies, which is in a disease state, what you're trying to do is you're trying to take a whole bunch of people who have a certain disease, or in this case a certain cancer, and you're comparing them to people who don't, and you're trying to see, well, what's the difference between the two groups. Those are really epidemiological biobanks. Those are big questions, and they're going to give us, you know, answers for the masses, but it's not going to tell a specific person what they need to know in their case. So it's an average of what's going to happen to a population. Different from that are the disease-specific banks. So in this case, what we're really doing is we're going to the people who have, in this case, cancer, and we're going to say, can we actually bank some of the tumor? Can we save it for research purposes? So usually some of it is used to make diagnosis, and then the rest is we get rid of it as medical waste. And we in research say, can we use that tissue now to do some of our research? And those are called clinical biobanks. And you can have them mostly they're built along disease sites, so you might have a breast bank or a prostate bank or different cancer banks. So I'm here at the Goodman, and I know that they do a lot of work on mice. And the mouse is a great model, but it's a great model for discovery. It's a great model for trying to figure out how things work. But eventually we have to say, but does this happen in patients? Is this really what's going on when somebody presents in the clinic with a cancer? And to address that question, what we really need to do is we have to have access to those patients, because they're the people with the cancers, but we also have to have access to their tumors, because that's the business end of the cancer. And that tissue that we get, then that tumor tissue, we can use it different ways. We can either have the fresh tissue that we use for research, or often what we'll do is we'll preserve it with a fixative, like formalin, and we'll put it in wax. So it's a formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue, and that allows us for many years to access that tissue and store it. We can do special things to the tissue to make it even more useful to research, and I'll give you a few examples. And we can also use that tissue to start growing things outside of the body that we can do research on. So, for example, in tumors, you know, one of the beauties of working with tumors is that's exactly what's in the patient. But one of the difficulties from a science point of view of using a tumor is that it's a messy piece of tissue, because it's got tumor in it, but it also has normal cells in it. Tumors need to have a blood supply, so there are cells that are bringing the blood. there are immune cells. You heard that your body tries to react against a tumor. So often you can find immune cells. So if you want to study just tumor cells in a tumor, it's difficult. So one of the tools that we have is something called laser capture microdissection that actually lets us, with a laser, choose the field of the tumor that we want to pull out and actually study it separately from, so we can look at the normal cells and we can look at the tumor cells from one piece of tissue. The other thing that we can do, which has really accelerated what we call translational research, and that's the ability to take the discovery work that we do and then try to apply it to a clinical problem, is to be able to group these tumor samples. So I told you that, you know, we can put these in wax molds, and then we can study them individually. And so if we wanted to look at, say, 400 women with a certain type of ovarian cancer, I'll use that example because it's one I know, I'd have to do the experiment over and over 400 times, and it could take me weeks or months to do it, and it would be very costly. But what we can do is we can group them now and say, I'm going to take that sample that I had, which is here sitting in wax, and I'm going to, with a fine needle, just take a little bit of that sample and put it in a new wax block. And I'm going to do that 400 times, one for every woman that I want to study. Now, instead of having to look at 400 of these original slides, I only have to look at one of them. So what's the advantage here? Well, I can go much faster. My results are much more reproducible. I'm not doing it on a day where maybe somebody's a little bit sloppy or my oven's not at the right temperature. I'm doing the 400 women under exactly the same conditions, so being able to compare them is really easy now. I also have lowered my cost because instead of having to do the experiment 400 times, I'm only doing it once, or maybe twice because I'm a scientist and I don't believe it the first time, so I'm going to check it again. The other thing, too, is that I know what happened to all of these women. I know which ones respond to treatment. I know which ones got better. I know which ones didn't. So now we can start to say, well, I've done my experiment. I have 400 results all in one experiment. The other thing is that tumors can grow outside of the body. So classically, we can take tumor cells and we can grow them on plastic and we can do experiments on them. But when they're growing like that, they don't really look like tissue looks inside of the body. They're flat. They don't have any neighbors. They don't act the same way as they necessarily do. But we've gotten fancier in the things that we can do. We can now grow them in three dimensions. And instead of growing flat, they grow more like balls or like tissues, the way you actually find them in patients. And then when we compare these to we can try to compare these to tumors and actually show that we're getting closer and closer to what actually happens in a patient when we do these in three dimensions. And we can start adding other cell types into it, immune cell types, and see how the tumor microenvironment is created. So it's opening new avenues of research where we can really dissect out the tumor microenvironment. So how do we go about, what's the life cycle of a tissue when it's in a tumor bank? And it all starts with the patient. So at the time, there's a presumed diagnosis. In fact, it starts even before the patient, because what it needs is for somebody or a group of people to say, we want to address this type of cancer and we really need access to samples. So they're going to need two things. They're going to need several things, but they're going to need funding to pay for this tissue banking. They're going to have clinical collaborators, because you need to know the surgeon, you need to know the oncologist, you need to know the pathologist to make tumor banking work, but you also need to have your patient. And for that, you also need to have the consent of your ethics boards. So if somebody wants to recruit patients to a tissue bank, they first have to go to their institutional ethics review board and explain to them why they need access and what type of research they're going to do, and explain the informed consent process. So once they get their ethics approval, the research nurse can then approach a patient who is looking at a diagnosis of cancer, explain the type of research we do, explain, and this is what we call the consenting process, explain what tissues that we want to have access, explain that we are also going to want to know things about them during the course of their disease, because what makes a tumor bank really powerful is not just the tissue when you get it, but knowing what happens to the patient afterwards. So I have a tissue, but I don't know if it's from a patient who did well, who did poorly, who responded to treatment, who didn't. It's a little bit of information. It's helpful. But it's not as helpful as if I know what happened to that person, because then I can start to put people in the right buckets. So this is explained to people in terms, and we can explain to them the type of research questions we're asking. Usually it's a specific pathology in ovarian. We introduce them to the type of team we have. Often we have information brochures that allow them to know about the type of research. So that's all done before the tissue is acquired through some medical or surgical procedure. Then the material is rapidly transported to the laboratory, and even if it's not rapidly, what we do is we always log the time that it takes from body to lab. So these are things that are important because they can impact the quality of our research. So we're looking at processing time, what temperatures do we keep that at, we said we can put them in different agents to fix them, which ones did we use. These are all important things that we need to know when we run a tumor bank. Then in a clinical bank, then we need to store these samples. We need to annotate them. That means we need to continuously to go back to the clinical file and say, okay, what's happening now to the patient? Are they, 24 months later, 36 months later, 48 months later? So it means a continual update of all of our clinical information. It means that we have to get the original pathology reports and really know which type of tumors we're talking about. And also, I'll talk a bit about more later, but we need to have standard operating procedures because we want to be able to compare my research results at the SHIM with the research results at the Siegel Cancer Center, and we want to make sure that we're doing things the same way so that we can compare between multiple centers. We also do, we can derive derivatives, we can make products from them, we have to do quality control to make sure that we're actually storing our tissue properly and that it's useful for research. And once we've done all of that and waited a few years for the data to percolate, it's ready for prime time research now. And so a researcher who has a specific question will go to an ethics board, will explain what the project is, it'll get accepted by the ethics board. They come then to you and say, I have ethics approval, I have scientific approval through my grant, can I access the tissue? Then the tissue is prepared, the experiments are done, and of course, because this is a non-renewable resource, we are continually rolling in patients into the tissue bank because as we use it up for research, we need more for the next question. So just as I said that as we heard that cancer, how we treat patients is changing, how we bank tissue samples is changing too. So in the 1990s, people were starting to realize the importance of tissue banks, and so we had what we now refer to often as boutique banks. So it would be a researcher with his buddy, the clinician or the pathologist, and they'd recruit, 20 women over the years, and they'd keep those tissues and they'd use them for their research. We realized fairly quickly, especially here in Quebec, that we needed to have something larger scale, more organized, if we really wanted to make rapid progress against different cancers. And so there was the creation of the Réseau de Recherche sur le Cancer, which is basically a cancer network which brings together different researchers and tries to formalize more of this banking activity. And then in 2004, at the federal level, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, and specifically the Institute of Cancer Research, and at the time it was Dr. Phil Branton here from McGill who was leading it, and who recognized how important this issue was, not just for Quebec, but for the entire country, and decided that really what we needed to do is formalize tumor biobanking at a Canadian-wide level. And that's so that we could standardize, first of all questions around ethics, but how do we treat samples, how do we keep the data, and how does the data in my database, which might be in French, talk to a database in Ontario that might be in English, but the same answer comes out when we try to put them together. And so one of the ways was through the creation of this cancer network. Now, not all of its activities are biobanking. It regroups over 100 researchers in the province of Quebec who are and clinician researchers, pathologist researchers, geneticist researchers, who are interested in looking at different facets of cancer, whether it's prevention, detection, personalized medicine, as we've heard, or new therapies. But to do that, we need to have access to high-quality samples, and it's, I told you one of the things we need is we need to have financing for that. So although we do get some money from the government, it's also been very important to establish relationships. And I didn't include this slide knowing that you would be here, but one of the partners here, the Breast Cancer Quebec Breast Cancer Foundation, is our partner for breast cancer banking. Procure, which is a foundation here in Quebec, is a major partner for prostate cancer. The Cole Foundation for Childhood Leukemias and Ovarian Cancer Canada supports us in part for our ovarian cancer banking. And this is also important because really what we're hoping to do is to eventually return research results to communities. So by having these foundations as our partners, we hope they're also going to be our partners in communicating back results. So just the different types of banks that we might have. So some of them, the tissues actually stay in the hospitals where they collect it, and the only thing that we're really sharing until it's time to actually do an experiment is the electronic data. But that doesn't include personal data. So a sample that comes in is given a unique identifier, a stripped of its names, addresses, hospital numbers. So that's not seen by anybody in the research world. And when we share the data, then none of that personal information is shared. There is a project here that is Cucro, Jerry Siegel. Jerry Battis from the Siegel has spearheaded this initiative, and it's really trying to organize clinical trials, which you heard Wilson talk about, but in this case it's clinical trials where we do tissue banking at the same time as you do the trial, which is very important because if you want to interpret the trial results, having the tissue of the person who was on the trial is very important. And really they've spearheaded biopsies because it's easy to often get the first cancer because you have surgery and you have a lot of tissue that can be shared with research. Later on with metastases, there might not be surgery. There might only be needle biopsies to confirm the spread of the disease. And so they've had to work out all of the conditions to be able to do that. And then we also have a leukemia bank, which is a little bit different, where all the samples are sent to a central site, and it's that's looked at. We have partners, which are the Canadian Tumor Repository Network, which, as I said, is very important to make sure that the way we bank tissues in Quebec is the same way they do it throughout Canada. And we also want to make sure that our policies for important issues of tissue banking, such as ethics, consent, privacy, is all the same. I see my time is running out. I just want to talk about two last little things about CedarNet. One is that they're certifying tissue banks and working on education, and education at various levels, education for the public, but education for researchers who used to work on mice and now want to work on and tissues and need to know how to handle it and how to use it, and also education for people who want to start new biobanks. So there are websites that I've included in my presentation, and I will skip through this part. I wanted to finish up. Oops, I lost my last slide there. Because it really is the conclusion of what I wanted to talk about, is that the tumor banks are really an important resource for our research, not just for new therapies, but for knowing who to treat, for early screening, for imaging. This is how we are going to make progress. It's a precious resource. It needs to be well-maintained and well-funded. And really, those of us who have been in the banking business for a long time know that these tissue banks are really gifts from donors, and they represent a legacy for research. Thank you very much.
Out on the fact that these samples
efficacy is still the best treatment possible. So I am I correct at least on the message is there for them?
Well, we hope that all of our patients get the best treatment possible, and certainly your treatment won't depend on whether you accept to be part of a tissue bank or not. It won't influence it. But I think, you know, having worked
use
with...
Use the microphone. Oh. You don't have to yell like
this. Having worked with consented women over the years, especially for ovarian cancer, which is a very deadly form of cancer, the five-year survival is less than 30%. Many of these women realize that the battle ahead ahead of them is very difficult, but being able to contribute their tissues to research and knowing that somehow that might make a difference someday for their sisters, for their daughters, for their friends, is something that's important to them also. So we take that responsibility very seriously, and we want to make sure that when we use those tissues, we really are using them for the best purpose in terms of clinical care.
Question. Dr. Bushman.
Well, there are tumors that that we can't biobank the tumor itself. And that's, you know, the good news is that some tumors are being detected so small now. I use breast cancer as an example with mammography, is that all of the tissue is required for diagnostic purposes. So we never use what we're using as tissue that is no longer required for diagnostic purposes. We're finding out, especially with the QCRO project, is that we're learning how to miniaturize our need for tumors. So in ovarian cancer, unfortunately, often what is excised at the time of surgery is kilograms worth of tumor. And so it's not difficult to be able to share it. And we didn't have to really work very hard on thinking about, well, how would we get by if we only had a little piece of tumor? Now, when we're doing these types of studies with biopsies, one of the things that the QCRO project has really looked at is, well, how do we take a small biopsy for that, and how do we get as much information as we can out of that so that we can get maximum use of even small pieces of tissue? But so it can be infinite, and I'll explain, is that I told you that we can take the cells from the tumor out and we can actually grow them outside of the body. Well, some of those have been growing since the 1950s. You know, that we have cell lines that many of us have used in our experiments, and so in that case it lasts forever. But that's an exception. That's not the rule. Usually what happens is that if they do grow outside of the body, they only grow for a little while and they die out because they're not really meant we haven't figured out how to really make them grow successfully. So usually we're limited to the tumor tissue itself, and then it depends on the size that you have. It depends on the type of experiments. But this is why I said we have some rare cancers that we've had for the last 20 years, and what we're waiting is to have enough rare cancers to put together to make a meaningful experiment, because if you only have one or two, you can do an experiment, but you can't really draw on any conclusion. So we're looking over decades, and the value of a tissue increases with time because we know what happens to the person. So in some cancers, like ovarian cancer, unfortunately, the time span to have an answer of what's going to happen is very short. But in other cancers, like prostate cancer, it can take, or even some breast cancers, it can take 5, 10, 15 years before you might have a recurrence or a second event. And so having tissue that's already 10, 15 years old is wonderful, because you're able to look back in time and see what's happened. So they can last a long time, a long legacy.
Thank you very much. I think we'll stop there. Thank you. I think we're learning quite a lot now. Our last presentation tonight comes from Antoinette Erler. Antoinette is infirmière pivot, navigation nurse, but she told me that maybe it's not exactly right. So why we invited Antoinette is to a bit tell us the human side of the hospital, how, and some of you may have seen infirmière pivot, how they are so crucial for a patient to see the researcher, the oncologist, the pathologist, all of these different people that they have to deal with. And I think your presentation is a bit that. But the human side of all of this, we see a lot of technology, but there's always the nurses at the end of the corridor. So that's what we want.
Thank you.
Thank you, Antoinette. There you go. Oh, I forgot to say two other things. Antoinette has a bachelor's degree in nursing from McGill University. She's doing a master's degree now at the State of Montréal. I don't know how you do this, by internet or something?
No, no, sur place
à Montréal. Okay, that's it. Laval is in Montreal.
Absolutely.
Competing with McGill. She's of course, infirmière pivot and the coordinator of all at the Siegel Cancer Center at the Jewish Hospital, and she's also an instructor at the McGill School of Nursing.
Parfait. La seule chose, c'est que je ne suis pas une infirmière pivot. I'm not an infirmière pivot. But I am the nursing coordinator for the Siegel Cancer Center at the Jewish General, and I work with a lot of my colleagues that are infirmière pivot, and I was involved also with the agence and the ministry level with nursing colleagues across the McGill network and Université de Montréal to create the role and all that. So as we've heard, there's a tremendous amount of information that you guys have received just now from our two previous speakers, so put yourself in the shoes of a patient. You've got this wealth of information, you know, that is out there. And on top of all that, it's above or below? Below, I guess. So above of all that, you've just been told that you have cancer. Now, this is one of the worst things that you want to hear, that actually you don't want to hear about. And what do? So you've got the diagnosis. There is tons of emotions going through your minds. Your present goals have all of a sudden but just been shattered. Your future goals, you don't know where you're going. You don't know what you're doing. And it's not just you. It's a whole network issue. It's a whole family issue. It's all your loved ones that get affected at the same time. It disrupts your psychological part. It disrupts your physiological, of course, social, spirituel. Name it, you're not the same anymore when you get that diagnosis. So, and the other thing that you've heard also with all the researchers is that you need to make a decision rapid. And at times, sadly enough, it's us, the professionals, that kind of put a lot of pressure in making decisions. So now what? What's your treatment? What have you decided? Okay, I know you've got cancer. I know you're emotional right now, but I want to see you next week, and we need to make a plan. We need to work together as a team. And you need to figure out what's the next step. So there's tremendous amount of research that has been done on actually information. And one of our major researcher, nurse leader in that aspect is Dr. Carmen Loisel. And it's in regards to the timely information and the support patients and families are receiving. Of course, going through that research aspect, it will help actually all the other professionals in any cancer center work with patients and families how to manage the demands of the illness, but also it contributes in helping patients and families monitor their own symptoms. It gives them a control and a sense of owning your own body, of your self-care, a sense of competence and empowerment, but that all comes with knowledge and information. Shared decision-making, you're not on your own. And actually, it's your body. There's a lot of decisions that you need to do, so you need to work with your professionals, with your nurses, your oncologist, your family physicians, the surgeon. But again, knowledge and information makes you a full-fledged partner in that team. And, of course, then, you know, what are the services out there? So here you've got this tremendous diagnosis, you feel your life has just been shattered, or your rug has just been pulled under your feet. So what is out there? Am I alone? Am I the only one that feels this way? And who could I ask for help? So again, information is tremendous on that. We've been doing patient focus groups. We've been talking to cancer networks. We've been talking to professionals. And what are they saying to us, basically? Patients and families are very dissatisfied with the information they're receiving. It's or too much, not at the right time, I'm not ready to hear this, or it's not enough. Let's say I'm ready to get information, but you're not giving to me the information. Another crucial element is not the same information is being given. So here we have, you know, you're seeing your oncologist, he or she is saying to you something, you're going to see, or your radio-oncologist, and it's like not exactly the same thing. Whether it's basically or simply the language they're using and you're not understanding the same language and then it's a whole perception thing, but there's a lot of misinformation and not the same thing is being said. Or what you do is you go and surf on the web. So are they evidence-based sites? Is it based on scientific research? And then here again, you're seeing a whole bunch of different information. So, and then going back to, again, the support in the community, what is out there? And I'm not even going to explain in detail what that causes to a patient and a family member. And again, when I'm saying patients, it includes partners. It could include a neighbor that has been very close with that patient. It's a family thing. Cancer is not just an individual. It's a whole community that's affected. Now, this is a little bit of a picture, actually, that you can see. It's a very small snapshot of what is the patient's reality. Who is he or she going to see throughout his or her continuum of care? So you've got the initial testing that goes on, and that could be with your GP. So there you go. You've got something going wrong, or you've got a mole, you're not sure. So there is, again, a whole bunch of questions that are going into your head. And then you see the general practitioner. Then you've got the initial diagnosis. So he's saying, you know what, I'm kind of worried about this. I'm going to send you to a specialist. So you go to a hospital. And there again, you're seeing a specialist. You're seeing another physician. You get more tests. And actually, once the testing is gone through, then you've got a diagnosis. And here you are with the blow. You've just been diagnosed with cancer. So you've got a lot of questions again in your head. Treatments. So there we go. Okay, now you have to go through treatment. There's surgery, there's radiotherapy, there's brachytherapy. You could go through a whole bunch of, do I go into a protocol? Do I not go to a research protocol? What is chemotherapy? And don't forget every time you're meeting different professionals. So that poor patient and their family member could wind up with 20, 30 individuals that they've met in a very short period of time. And who do I ask what question? And then you've got post-treatment. You've got patients that are in remissions, and then you're saying, okay, I've got 20 to 25 people that I met for the last year or so. Now they're saying, I'm in remission, I'm fine, I'm alone. But I'm not the same person I was a year ago. Who, I've got my worries, is this going to come back? Oh my God, I'm having a cold, I've got fever, does that mean it's back again? Who do I call? Who of those 25 people is going to be there for me and answer my questions? And then there's information gaps throughout the whole continuum of care. So with all this, there's a lot of research that has been done, and now we're going into different modalities to guide patients actually through or navigate patients through the maze, because this is exactly what patients and families have been saying. C'est un labyrinthe. We don't know if we go right, do we go left, if it's fine to go left or right or up or down. We need to have different modalities of care across the province of Quebec and all cancer centers to help patients and families and make sense of their experience and go through all this. And the most important thing is the right care from the right person to the right patient at the right time. It's a question, it's very much a question of time, and this really portrays the word efficiency. We don't have time to waste. We're in the midst of budget issues, budget crunch, this and that. We need to look at efficiency. Who's the right person that could answer that question to that patient and guide them at the right moment? So that was a question that has been asked many, many years ago with a whole bunch of interdisciplinary team members, and there were different models that came out. So you've got three sections of patient navigation models. I'm going to be concentrating on the professional aspect. the peer one, and I could just talk for the Siegel Cancer Center. An example is the Wellness Center, Hope and Cope, a lot of support systems available for patients and families. You've got the Virtuel, and Virtuel is very upcoming. It is here. People are on the net. People use computers. It is out there. So as professionals, we have to go into using that technology for our patients and families. And Dr. Loisel is doing amazing research in virtual navigation systems for our patient population. And we're actually doing a lot of across Canada research with a few models that she's been developing. So I'm going to be concentrating on the professional aspect. Now, the professional aspect is basically the individual, the professional who will help navigate the patient through the system. Well, in 1997, the PQLC, which is Le Programme Québécois de la lutte contre le cancer, has been starting to listen or maybe just hearing exactly what patient advocates and professionals have been saying, that there are tremendous needs for a patient population. And the two major needs that came out really was that there is a problem with access of information and continuity of care, and support patients and family through symptom management, through the experience of cancer. We're talking about diagnosis and all that. Finally, through the same time in 94 and 2004, there was a huge research program that was put into place in the entire province of Quebec by the Ministère de la Santé et des Services Sociaux. And they came up with a conclusion that each patient requires an intervenant pivot. They haven't named it that it's a nurse yet, but it's basically an individual that follows the patient through the whole trajectory. So in 2004, first time they did label this as a nurse, being the individual with the knowledge centrally that could help navigate patients and family across the whole trajectory and the experience. And we had 41 infirmières pivots that were in the province of Quebec, and a few of them, the majority were actually in the region of Montreal. 2009, we were up to 220 infirmières pivots. We sadly in 2011 have not increased tremendously in the numbers, and it's all a question of budget. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us. Now, the role of the infirmière pivot, of course, is to manage, assess physical and psychosocial needs of patients and the symptoms, and always with the family. She teaches and provides information to patients and families. She gives support, of course, and coordinates and ensures continuity of care. Those are the four major pillars for role of an infirmière pivot. And what it makes it also quite unique is that the infirmière pivot is present at diagnosis. Now, I'm talking about the ideal situation. We do not have enough infirmière pivot in the province of Quebec to be able to do this. But the ideal situation is at the moment of diagnosis, and we're looking, hopefully in the future, even at the pre-diagnosis phase, when there is some thought that potentially this is going to be a cancer diagnosis, that this nurse is involved at that period and then follows the patient until the end of life issues. So it is a tremendous role that patients and families can really rely on throughout the whole trajectory. The interesting also thing with the infirmière pivot is that she or he actually is part of an interdisciplinary team. They're not alone. So they belong with oncologists, physicians, social workers, psychologists, but there is that central individual that is always present for the patient throughout the whole continuum. And this is just a very fast snapshot of what is at the Siegel Cancer Center. So we have 16 IPOs out of 13 teams. Now, 16 because some teams, because of statistics, have two IPOs, such as breast and hematology. We do have, sadly, some specific teams in cancer care that don't have an IPO. And, again, it's going strictly back to budget and not having the funds for the position. This is examples of just numbers. And this is, so new patients, total of the 13 IPO. In 1 year, they had 1,193. The following 12. But not to forget, the majority of the 1,193 new patients are still alive. So it's adding on to their caseload. And we've got very senior IPOs, example in hematology, that has over 650 families that they're following. And she's been doing that for 5 years. So it is tremendous. You'll see the number of visits. What you'll see a big difference is number of phone calls in 1 year, from 5,000 to 10,000. So it's a lot of prevention that they're doing. We're actually preventing over one-third of the patients that are coming to see the IPO and in the phone do not go to eMERGE. So there's a major, major prevention aspect that they're doing also at the same time. And that is because there's a relationship. Future, we need more IPOs. So this year, this June, with the government of Quebec and the PQLC, again, the program, Programme de la lutte contre le cancer, we're doing a massive provincial research project where we're going to be analyzing the actual need in each center and basically with each patient that every new diagnosis, 70% of every new diagnosis will have access to an IPO within 48 hours, which I predict about 10 times the numbers of IPOs that we already have. So I'm not sure we're going to get there, but research will help. This is an amazing quote. This is really what comes and probably summarize potentially even everything that we're saying is from Dr. Everett Koop, former U.S. Surgeon General, and basically the best prescription is information. And again, through evidence-based care, innovation, and collaboration, we can, as a team, including patients and families, make a difference. This is it's a team effort. Thank you. Merci. It's a lot. Once you've got a relationship established with une infirmière pivot, that relationship goes on for years and years and years until the end. And actually at that stage when there is maybe a reoccurrence or that where you feel in the survivorship phase, when you feel that you're a little bit alone and everybody's cheering you on, saying, come on, you should be happy, it's great, you've beat this, you're good. You feel a little bit let down, and when it could just be because of a cold, you all of a sudden feel another mass, or you're not sure about something, or you just have a question in general, that IPO is there.
So the first question we have, in fact, exactly, is the IPO the oncology nurse? Do you say that? Is it specific for oncology?
It is specific for oncology, but we could probably extrapolate as infirmière pivot in psychiatry in the future, infirmière pivot maybe in women's health issue, whatever. But specifically, IPO is for oncology, and it is a nurse that has at least a university, an undergrad degree. At the Siegel, we're pushing for a graduate degree. All the IPOs have master's degree right now and experience in cancer care and just basically ready for that adventure. Yes, I agree 100%. And yes, we had situations where the patient, because it becomes a partnership with the IPO, shared the concern that there is a particular family member that has this need to be involved. So therefore, what we're doing is there were numerous family meetings as a team. And if need to, that individual that has this urgent need to help, we would direct them to maybe canaliser l'énergie, maybe somewhere else, or actually at one situation we had some psychological support given to that specific individual, not being the patient but affected the patient. Yes.
If you have to go, I have my mother's finger cut. We'll have a talk. So I had that in my young days. Okay. Thank you.
I'm just going to do one few little things at the end of our evening. What I want to show you is, in fact, I'm going to go here. No, sorry. And I'm almost there. I passed that very quickly. If it comes back, yes. So just, I talked about pancreatic cancer. We have two other evenings after the holidays. Lung cancers we'll have on March 13. It's something that we wanted to do for a long time. And melanoma, as I mentioned to you. One thing I forgot to mention, and Nicole, Dr. Beauchemin is there in the back, since I would be in Japan with this little kid trying to avoid radioactivity, Nicole will be our host for the two nice evening and after in 2012. Nicole, thank you very much. Dr. Beauchemin is a scientist, a survivor, also a very good contributor for the Canadian Cancer Society here in Quebec. And she knows all of these issues here. She's dealt with this. So I think it will be wonderful for you to help us. And I thank you very much. Now, those of you that wants to go can go. I should first thank a few people that it's very important. But also I was asked to pass again, as you know, the Goodman Cancer Center made a video about cancer, which has close to now 200,000 clicks. So we're wonderfully happy with the response we had. This was an idea that we had with Rosalyn, but also two other volunteers in our group. I'd like, and we'll see this, you'll see on the video. I'd like, though, for tonight, thanks the volunteer that organized our evening. Marla Shuster, Alita Lebovich, Sheila Nutkin, Dale Boydman, of course, Rosalind, which are part of that. I'd like to thank also Alexandra Semra from the office. We're pretty short. And, of course, Annette Novak, which has done a fantastic job for us. And I'd like to thank them and applaud them because they're doing everything we can. So for those which wants to go and seen this video 50 times, I know my mother did. So I think what happens, yeah, exactly that letter that Jack. No, it's very funny because people come in the center and they recognize me not as a director, but hey, you're the guy with the jacket. But we had wonderful people having a good time there. If I can start the video, I hopefully it's not long. It's 3 minutes. I don't know why it's not like this. Let me see. Why is it not starting? I'm going to get it out and put it back in. I think that will go to your video. I don't know what that's. Hey? My country closed. I don't know. Let me see this. It's going to come out, hopefully. And I'll put it back and it's going to start. So this was something we talked about to explain a bit what we're doing in the center, do a bit of how the scientists do in the lab. It's a serious, unserious video. And also we have sponsors, Mediacom, which are sponsoring also, and Pentafarm, which is a new sponsor because it was so popular. It's starting now. I'm going to start from the start. Okay, now we go, and close the light. Close the light. But no, don't too much. I want people, if they have to leave, I don't want them to get killed. The video will have 200 clicks and 5 kills. No, that would be so good. Here, but I must say to you, we were so delighted by this, and hopefully you'll enjoy. I came to dance, 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 dance. I hit the floor cause that's my plans, 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 plans. I'm wearing all my favorite brands, 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 brands. Give me some space for both my hands, 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 hands. You, cause it goes on and on and on. And it goes on. Great to do this. We had a wonderful time, and it was not easy to get the Dean of Medicine dancing there with Phil Gold, which is known in the Hall of Fame of Medical School in Canada. He discovered CA, discovered a marker that started the Goodman Cancer Center, and he participated. So thank you for the evening. Hopefully you'll be back for the pancreatic cancer evening we have. I think it's going to be very special that evening. So looking for, do the sheet and the, if you have any comment, please, that's important for us. And have a good evening going back home. Bonsoir. Is there a link? Yes, you can find it. Yeah. And pass it around, you know. Each clicks give us money.
Turn on the light. How do we turn the light? Yeah, absolutely right.
And that's what trying to change.
Yeah. So anyway, if they decide to contact you, I would like to give that to Annette and making sure that she knows who you are and that you never know. I don't want to say maybe that could be something.
Okay.
Take care of yourself.
Well, the jury is still out. The Lalders and the speech therapist said we can't guarantee the outcome, but we just have to wait and see. But the prognosis is
okay.
So that's
okay.
The challenge.
My CD after I...
I'm giving it to you.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Good night. So... Yeah, okay, it's to start. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same thing we do. Not sure was it the right thing for the university?
Yeah, that I don't know, but I mean, if people found it that it was a good rounded,
there's a lot of they learned a lot of things.
Yeah, they thought it was a lot of information.
Yeah.
And
Wilson was probably too
technical. I told him to dumb it down.
He didn't do it?
I spoke to him earlier. As a matter of fact, this morning.
And
he said to me, well, I didn't really have time to redo my PowerPoint, so I said, well, then you better verbally dumb it down, because your PowerPoint that you do to lectures are not going to be okay here.
No, and I think that most of them were that. And the ones that were not like that, they were terrible. I'm going to have a drink with them. We often go to a wine bar.
I did tell him to dumb it down. I said your slides that you do for your lectures are not going to be,
So I think it'd be important that.
Marie is
very good. Oh, she's
great.
And Marie is a fantastic person, and she for years she's been working for the community with no benefits, and that's why I thought when you needed. She would be there. And a lot of people heard that, quite a lot of reagents for research. And we told her this would not happen. And this only hard work, no benefit to her for about 12 years. Yeah. She sent me a few little things with mice, but the center is not like that anymore.
Oh, I heard that. Yeah.
Because, we have. Are now working with different things. So it was perhaps true maybe 5 years ago when the only real one working with patients was MRI Park.
Okay.
Now it's not true anymore.
Okay.
And it's
okay.
Going to be less and less true. So I just mentioned that to you. I want to give you the card of this gentleman, because before you, that's fine. There's no promise here. It's just I want to tell you that in case.
He would want.
Potentially. He didn't say yes to me, but if we ask, maybe you don't know. But if you need him.
You know, he just had a stroke.
Yeah, I know.
I have.
she'll be here too, and I think it would be nice to show it to her. But it's been going across the country. If you know,
I know.
My friends from Vancouver have all seen it, and, but they're probably more linked to the cancer community.